You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armorall, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armorall products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at Armorall.com. Armorall, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
From Autosport.com and Autosport Magazine, I'm Martin Lee, and this is the Autosport Podcast. It's that time. Welcome to a brand new series of our top 10s. Well, we call them Kev's top 10s. I'm not sure whether we've ever officially approved that name, Kevin Turner, our chief editor, but we'll call it Kev's top 10s.
Yeah, it's been, I think it's been out there. Sometimes it's been Kev's top 10s, and then sometimes it's just been top 10s, which probably makes more sense. We have had some guest 10s where I've been the sort of pundit as well, haven't I? So
here we go. Yeah. Series 5, if anyone is keeping counts.
If you are, well done.
That one person should get a prize.
Do you agree?
Kev, what's this series going to be about?
So we're doing something different this time. We're going to do the British Touring Car Championship. So we've done 3 F1 series, Le Mans last year, obviously for centenary. We did that cool pre-war. My Christmas task last time, 2022, was to do all the pre-war stuff that we did at the start of last year. And this year's Christmas was British touring car related. So, yeah, we're going to give the BTCC a go as we run up to the new season.
Wonderful. So here we are back at Silverstone. Today we are recording on... This is hallowed ground. This is the BRDC clubhouse. No one gets to come in here.
Well, no, thank you very much to the PRDC for letting us have this this space. It's great to be looking. It's a shame there's nothing going around. Sometimes we're fortunate enough to have something going around, but it is a bit damp and miserable. So, yeah, but still nice to have a backdrop.
Well, our first special guest does get to come in here because he's proudly displaying his BRDC sticker on the back of his very nice car that I was envious of walking past today. But will you please introduce him, Kevin?
Ah, well, it's the lead BTCC commentator, David Addison. Welcome, David. How are you doing?
Thank you. Yeah, I'm good. Thank you very much. Looking forward, like everybody, to a whole new season. It's this off-season. I know there are other races that go on, but we just want to get on with touring cars. And with a late start this year, end of April, can't come soon enough.
Do you enjoy this time of year for some downtime, or are you just chomping at the bit?
It's not really that down a time, strange enough, because I managed to find various things to do. 7th of January, I went to Eastbourne, which is really handy from Cheshire, and that was for a stock car meeting. And I'm doing the Carrera Cup GB Esports Championship. So we've got 8 rounds of that, which is great because I can do that from home on a Sunday afternoon. And I quite enjoy esports racing, even though I'm an old fart and it's completely away from what I'm used to. I've really enjoyed doing it over the last few years. So that keeps me out of trouble. And it's good when you've got one or two real world people in an esports championship because it gives you a good combination of seeing their ability against sim racers. But yeah, there's a stack of books to catch up on that I haven't got round to over the last few months. And, time with my daughter and my wife. They seem nice. So yeah, it's coming together.
By April, they're like, Dad, go and work.
Exactly.
Dad, you have some work to do. You can...
in December, there was a Oval National Hot Rod meeting I went to, and it was snowed off. And I was the first one at the gate, and I was the first one to discover that you couldn't get through the gate up to the pits because the snow was just so bad. So I was back home for 10:30, and the disappointment in the face of Mrs. Addison as I walked through the door was palpable. You're home? Oh, God. Now what do we do?
What's he doing back? And our second special guest to do this kickoff, this new series, is our own Autosport's own Marcus Simmons, who I think the last time I saw you, we were probably watching Super Touring Power, weren't we, at Brands? It was like 6 months we were last in the same room.
Well, we were, yeah. What was frustrating me is that we were actually doing the interviews on the stage while the races were going on.
Yeah, yes. This year.
I was hoping we'd find a window in between races so I could zip over trackside. But yeah, Martin, I'm disappointed that you mentioned David's BRDC sticker on his car, but not the Brentford FC stickers on the back of the Simmons family Skoda. So,
yes, I brushed past your Skoda and Kev's 25-year-old BMW.
Which is the most relevant car in the car parts of the discussion we're going to have today, I should point out. It is the car top, though. It's not the actual coupe, but never mind.
Let's get into it. All right, brand new series. Let's talk touring cars. What are we going to start with for this first one?
Top 10 BTCC champions, which you could say is the greatest British touring car drivers of all time, except for a couple of exceptions that were really annoying me when I was putting the list together. So I thought I'd save myself some aggro and create a second list, thereby creating actually even more aggro. So we're going to do a non-champions list later. Yes. So there are one or two names that are fairly obvious that we won't be talking about so much today that will potentially appear on that episode. So yeah, top 10 champions, overall champions, because obviously there were some drivers who won the class title back in the day when they had the idiosyncratic system of, you know, you could win your 1,000cc class and be overall champion while people up front blasted around in V8s and things. So it's overall champions that we're discussing today.
You might be in for a grilling today.
I'm slightly concerned because, well, one of our guests has already showed his disdain for 10. And I'm very aware that our two guests are very experienced and will have lots of evidence and good arguments to put forward. And also, I'm slightly scared that they might gang up on me together as well.
All right, well, look, let's get into it. It's always... Other shows in this series, we'll talk non-champions. Matt Q will join us for a show about the greatest cars, and we'll talk about the Super Touring era as well, which, of course, I should mention, by the way, that is back at Brands this summer. We'll see you there, and we'll try and do the interviews on stage when there's no track action for you. So we'll try.
Thanks, Martin.
We'll try and organise that. Let's get into it. Number 10 is always very difficult because number 10 inevitably there's some 11s and 12s didn't make it, but we can't then give away some of the names in the top 10. It's always a bit interesting to kick off the top 10. But who have you put at 10?
So number 10 is Matt Neal, 63 wins, 3 titles. So, yeah, I think probably this is a good point to talk about the criteria. This isn't just simply a list of the best drivers who have ever sat in a British touring car or ever done a British touring car race. I think you have to bring in their impact on the championship, longevity. It's not just about who are the best drivers. And I've also tried to spread the joy across the eras. I didn't want to just do, oh, here are a load of Super Touring drivers and a couple of other people. Which I suspect could be one of Marcus's points, which we'll come to later on. But I thought, I don't believe that Matt is one of the absolute best talents that's been on the grid. You know, he's been beaten by various teammates over the years in various cars. You know, Giovinardi when they were at Vauxhall, Gordon Chen got the better of him eventually at Honda. But I think he's started more than 700 races. He's such an intrinsic part of the championship. 63 wins does still put him third on the all-time list, which is not bad going. Three championships. And, of course, I think he's a bit of a fan favourite. Most notably with the privateer Nissan Primera winning at Donington, £250,000. Anyone that takes that amount of money off Alan Gow is going to go down well with the fans. So, he had to be on the list. So there he is at 10. So here we go. Who's going to go first to shoot that down?
There are a few caveats to this, inevitably. And that is, you're right, 63 wins is a good number. But a lot of that was done in an era where there were three races to a day and some in two races to a day, where the likes of a Gordon Spice or a Stuart Graham as a prolific race winner could never get anywhere near that number. And with respect to Matt, some of that success came at a time, and this is true of other people I think we're going to discuss, where the championship was not at its strongest. You know, many of those wins, there was a big rivalry amongst him and Jason Plato, and to a degree, you can put Fabrizio Giovinardi into that mix over certain seasons. But you didn't have the depth of strength, I don't think, that other years did. Now, that's not to say that he wasn't a deserving champion, because you can only beat the people that you're racing against. but it kind of needs to go in the context of the era, I think.
Yeah, and that's kind of why I wanted to try and pick... With Formula 1, the list's quite easy, because although, of course, we can say that some years were more competitive than others, generally, F1's the pinnacle, and we know that there are lots of good teams and drivers in it, whereas with something like touring cars, it's much more up and down. It's had some really strong periods and some really weak ones. But I did want to try and get a spread of... And I think, actually, there have been weaker periods than the one that Matt's operated. You know, he was independent champion four times during super touring, all the way through BTCT. I mean, I agree with your points, but and all the way into the early years of the NGTC as well. So he's had, I would suggest, more rivals than some of the people we talk about on this list. But Mark, can see Marcus is desperate to jump in.
Well, I will echo most of what David said and a bit of what Kevin said.
And then still disagree.
And then disagree. How is the fence that you sat on?
I think Matt has had a big impact on the British Touring Car Championship over 30 years, really. And not just as a driver, but as a team principal as well in latter years. Kevin mentioned the independence win in the Super Touring era. I don't think we all realised quite how good that Nissan Primera was at the time.
It was better than the works car at that point, wasn't it?
I agree that the era where he did most of his winning was not as strong as many other eras, especially since we went to the single class era in the early 1990s. You know, Matt's success, a lot of it was in the BTC touring era, which was probably the weakest that we've had of single class BTCC racing.
Don't want to say it wasn't single class. Well, because you had BTC touring and BTC production to try and boost the numbers.
I'm sorry, but the BTC production were never eligible for the overall championship.
It's true.
I would argue just being purely puritanical, if that's not an oxymoron. I would say that Gordon Shedden, who drove alongside Matt as his teammate and his friend for many years, is a better BTCC champion than Matt, purely as a driver, because his successes came in what I would argue would be a more competitive era. So he didn't have the number of starts of Matt, he didn't have the number of wins of Matt, but it was against a stronger field, I believe, and probably a bigger achievement for Shedden to win the championships when he did against Matt Neal. So I think I really like Matt. He's a really good guy, I wouldn't disagree with him being in the top 10, but I might necessarily say that there are other people who didn't make it into the top 10 who would be above him in mine.
What I'd like to have seen from Matt, and to a degree it's circumstances outside his control, was more of him for other teams, because on the rare occasion that he drove outside the family team, like the year that he had with the Works Vauxhalls, for example, he didn't do brilliantly. Now, there might be lots of reasons for that, but within the family team, as it were, team dynamics, obviously there was the right fit, and it was kind of built around him. The fact that they had success with other drivers, I think, illustrates how good in its peak the team was. So I echo, yes, Marcus is right, that his contribution as both a driver and a team principal, he definitely should be in the top 10. But I'd love to have seen what he could have achieved purely as a driver for another team, not just team dynamics.
Yeah, I'd agree with all that. I mean, it's fair to say that his strike rate is one of the lowest, like, of the drivers I looked at. And on pure driving, I would put Shedden ahead of Matt as well. Like, well, you can see when they were teammates what happened. So, yeah, but I just think that his impact got him on the list for me. And, of course, he won the 60th anniversary race as well, which I thought was quite cool. But before we move on then, obviously you mentioned Gordon. Who else that isn't in the 10 before we start racing down the list do you think? Because I've got a couple of names that really are sort of in and out, in and out, in and out, right until virtually the last minute. So who would you guys have put in that aren't in the 10 champions that I've chosen?
My number one pick would be Rickard Rydell. his...
Ooh, interesting. Okay. He wasn't on my bubble at all.
Yeah, so he was absolute class, quality driver. It was really neck and neck between him and Alain Menu for the last 4 or 5 years of the Super Touring era, which in my opinion is far and away the most competitive era of BTCC. I don't want to denigrate what we've got now, but it was the Super Touring era was as close to Formula One standards of professionalism in driving and engineering and everything around the championship. Actually, maybe saying comparing it to Formula One is a little bit unfair. I'd say Le Mans hypercar now. It was that level of the sport that we now see with Le Mans hypercar. So I would massively argue for Ricard to be up there, because I don't want to be a spoiler, but we all know Alain Menu is going to be in this top 10 somewhere.
I don't think that's a huge...
And I would say between him and Ricard, it would be, you know, on any weekend over those last 5 years of Super Touring, I would say that the balance could tip between one or the other of them, and he would be my number one pick to go in the top 10 isn't there at the moment.
What about you, David?
I wouldn't argue with putting Ricard in, because Marcus is absolutely right, and he was incredibly quick, and rarely did you talk about him being off the road. You know, he was largely error-free. Out of the more modern era, the one I would consider putting in would be Gordon Shedden, because as hard a racer, you will not find. And maybe we can touch on this, I think, in the context of somebody that is on that list, but you kind of overlook sometimes just how committed and good a driver is because of the persona outside the car. And in a modern age like this, where drivers are so media friendly, they come across as being a character, in quotes. But that tends to take your eye off looking at what their true ability is and how ruthless they can be in a car.
Yeah, that's all fair sense. The Rydell one's interesting. Well, I'm sure we'll come back to the Super Touring subject at a later time. But I'm going to throw a couple of names in, Martin, before you move on, if I may. So the one I felt bad about leaving out was Wyn Percy, because I think he was an absolute class act and he's actually a bit underrated by history. The reason he didn't get in is I was putting an emphasis on overall wins rather than class. And let's face it, the RX-7, that was not a touring car. How the hell did Tom Walkinshaw get that in? Amazing.
Same way Porsche got the 911.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. John Fitzpatrick, bit of an honourable mention to him. He won the class title lots of times. And probably the one that more fans will resonate with is John Cleland, who will be on a future list. You can probably guess which one that would be, who didn't quite make it in because he wasn't quite strong enough in Super Touring. And he didn't do quite enough in Group A beforehand, because winning the championship in 89 in the Astra, I don't think even he particularly rates that success.
Well, the class was so poorly supported that Vauxhall had to put extra cars out with rally drivers to get the maximum points available.
And he could fake... you can see the bit of track he was on where he fake stalled at the finale so he didn't get taken off by BMW, and it took him no time at all to come through all the class rivals. So he's the other one that, in terms of impact on the championship, actually, John's a real character, and I think he's going to come up quite a few times in our various lists, but he's the other one I sort of felt a little bit bad leaving out.
All right, well, let's get on to number 9 then. Who did you put in?
So, number 9, and I was moving him around.
You're laughing
the last
already
minute.
Now.
Well, I'll be honest, I wasn't a fan. Number 9 is Fabrizio Giovinardi, 2006-10, and he also did a year in 2014 Motorbase Focus, which we probably won't be talking about very much. 24 wins and 2 titles. I remember watching Giovinardi. I mean, absolute touring car legend. He won championships all around Europe. When I watched him before he even came to BTCC, I thought he was a bit of a bish-bash-bosh merchant, honestly. Perhaps that made him well-suited to the BTCC when he arrived with Jason. But then him and Jason actually got on all right, so who knows? Perhaps they cancelled each other out. So, he struggled a little bit to start with the Sport Hatch, which was a bit hopeless. Even Müller struggled a bit with that car, Ivan Müller. But then once he got the Vectra, the S2000 Vectra in 2007 and 2008, he was the class act. 1 year he won miles more races than any other the other one, he put together a consistent campaign that's better than anyone else, and he almost made it three on the bounce in 2009, just lost out in that sort of fantastic brands showdown with Colin Turkington and Jason Plato. So, yeah, I think his impact was quite big. Like, a lot of people you speak to from that time, if you go and look at our season reviews and things, like, he's regarded as the class at benchmark that just came straight in, foreign superstar, and did the job. So, yeah, he was never my favourite driver, I have to be honest. And the 2014 thing, when he came back motorbase and got thumped by teammate Matt Jackson, wasn't great. But he was 47 by then, to be fair. And the NGTC cars are a bit weird. So I'm not really holding that against him.
Let's do the motorbase thing first of all, because a motorbase car could be a career killer in some ways. Not many people drove one of those, with the exception of Matt Jackson.
And came out not now it isn't
with glory. Not now, but when it was the original motorbase team, you know, Giovinardi came with a stellar CV and got his hat well and truly nailed on, and was made to look a bit average. Andrew Jordan went there and soon realised the error of his ways, and that car just didn't deliver for him. So, if you take Giovinardi's career based on that last season, I don't think he was given the tools for the job. So you're right, let's park that. And I'm a bit with you. I was never a great fan. And part of that was seeing him in the European Championship in the year that he drove for BMW. Up against, so he'd driven for Alfred, won championships in Italy. He went to the ETCC and was snaffled away by BMW. And I can remember being at the first ever event in Dubai, the Autodrome, and somebody in the press room saying, did you see Giovinardi in that first race? It's like he still drives for Alfa, because all he seemed to do was drive into the other BMWs. And the year after, he was back with Alfa Romeo again. So discuss. So you're right. There was that sort of crash and bash merchant. And I seem to remember his first outing in the BTCC was a bit Laurent Aiello-ish, as in it was a bit of a disaster. And then he got better and better as the year wore on. And I've got to use the line again. It was of the time. Yes, he was the benchmark driver of that time, against relatively little opposition. Relatively. I mean, Matt Neal, Colin Turkington, Jason Plato, good drivers. But, you know, it wasn't like a World Touring Car, European Touring Car grid. It wasn't like a Super Touring Car grid.
But I think that's the point, just before you jump in, Mark. I think that if we compare all eras to Super Touring, they're going to be lower. I think, actually, it's Super Touring that's out of step. Super Touring was a ridiculous period where millions of pounds were being spent on domestic touring car championship. Mm. So it's kind of out of kilter. Mm. I think that the other periods actually match up. Well, okay, it's a bit of up and
But I suppose
down.
My point is that if he's got that reputation and that CV as a touring car champion elsewhere, and he came into this, then he should have won it.
And what I like about Fabrizio Giovinardi, and I must say that his period in the BTCC, I wasn't really at BTCC races, so I didn't see much of it, but what I like about what he achieved is in the BTCC is that he wasn't exactly in the first flush of youth even then. He said he was 47 when he came back in 2014. He'd won multiple championships in Super Touring cars and then Super 2000 cars, nationally, internationally, and then came to a sort of, By the late 2000s, was a sort of fairly parochial but fiercely competitive championship, and won it twice. And you just think, blimey, that's a really good achievement. That would the respect that he's due for that would be a bit like if, sadly, touring car racing outside the BTCC, if you look around Europe especially, is at a bit of a low ebb at the moment. We don't really have a comparable level championship. But if there was one in, say, Italy or Germany or somewhere like that, and Colin Turkington, at the age he is now, went over and won that championship, you'd think, wow, what a superstar. That's a fantastic achievement to go over there into a completely different motorsport culture and win it. Like, maximum respect to him, and that I think is why we should perhaps give credit to Giovinardi for doing what he did in the BTCC, just because he stepped into a completely different culture, having won so many things outside of this country, and was still at the top of his game.
All right, let's move on. Number eight, a name you've mentioned briefly already.
Number eight, Zivan Müller, 1998 to 2005, 36 wins, one title. Now, Muller, I moved all over the place in this list because in terms of raw ability, like, you kind of think, oh yeah, Muller was great. You know, respected by everyone. Car control was incredible, always in the thick of the action. And then you go and look, well, he lost the championship three times to his teammates during the supposed, you know, the weaker era with the Astra Coupe when it was miles quicker than everyone else. He lost once to Jason Plato, twice to James Thomas. I mean, it was nip and tuck in each of these cases, really. And he did win, obviously, in 2003. So I thought, He perhaps didn't do quite as well as he should have done, but he had a huge impact on the championship. I think, again, he was regarded as the class act. Autosport massively hedged its bets in 2001, by the way. Season View had equal number ones for Plato.
Was that Plato and Muller? Was that my fault?
No, it wasn't your fault. No. So Muller did normally top the driver ratings, but obviously, whoever it was, I think it might have been Toby Waller, covered the championship that year and decided that he didn't want to get in because obviously it got quite cantankerous and horrible that fight. Normally, I think Jason was the aggressor, if we're honest. I think he would probably agree with that now. And so Autosport just hedged its bets and gave them both number one, which I will not do in my top 10 listing. So, I think in terms of, you know, ability, impact had to be there. 36 wins, I think, puts him tied for seventh in the all-time wins list. So it was obvious that he would be in the list for me. I just really struggled to know where to put him because of his basically not nailing more titles, really, against teammates.
I mean, I became a massive fan of Ivan Muller. I admired him as a driver anyway, because in my early years of my career at Motoring News, I covered some 1992 British Formula 2 Championship rounds. Was it called British Formula 2 or Formula 3000? Then David
Formula 2,
remember.
Right, yeah, yeah. Formula 2, yeah.
Which, and he cleaned up in that.
Mm. Hang on, how long before Whipple managed to get a mention of F2? It's longer than normal.
but when he came over in 1998 to drive the Audi, and they'd switched to front wheel drive for that season, and he'd very smartly spent a year in the German series driving the front wheel drive Audi voluntarily when four wheel drive was clearly the thing to have, because he wanted to get a step ahead on when Audi would be front wheel drive, and that front wheel drive Audi in 98 was pretty hopeless, but Muller was just absolutely fantastic in it. He was just absolutely ragging it everywhere, completely sideways, dragging results out of it. It had no right to achieve. And then he went to the Vauxhall team the year after in the Vectra, and that wasn't the best car in the championship. But he was his first win at Brands Hatch, where you might remember this, David.
I was commentating on it. Yeah,
Where he got the double toe and went from third to first on the Indy circuit at Brands going into Paddock Hill Bend. Now, I mean, in a super touring race, making one overtaking manoeuvre on anyone around the Brands Hatch Indy circuit during an entire 30-lap race is actually not the work of a moment, but he did two in one go to take the lead. And that was a sort of announcement, I'm here, wasn't it? And Kevin mentions that he only won one championship, but the other thing you have to remember is that the 2001 one in particular, where it was him against Jason Plato with James Thompson as the outside shot in the Egg Sport Astra. So they were all in 888 run Vauxhall Astras, which were theoretically identical in performance, but we have to remember that anybody out of those three who had a bad day was always going to finish in the top three, because fourth was Phil Bennett or one of the Peugeots, which weren't very good. Whereas if you transfer that to any other era, any one of them having a bad day would be down in ninth or something like that. So the points differential for a bad day was virtually nothing, and you were always going to keep yourself in contention. So I think that's one of the reasons why Muller only won one championship, just because there was so few contenders at the time. It was for a couple of years. It was him, Jason Plato, and James Thompson. And the funny thing is that the person who won two titles in that era was James Thompson, and he's not on our list yet. Jason won one title in that era and another one later on, of course. And
I,
Annie Van won one title, and they are on the list. James was just super consistent through that era, but fast as well. But
he only marginally missed out in terms of wins to Muller across that period. Yeah. Like, he's quite close. Tomo very nearly made this list. I mean, I was a big the opposite to the Giovinardi thing. Yeah. I loved James Thompson. I thought he was great.
Yeah, he was great. And wasn't there one championship where Tomo snatched it from Muller in the final race of the season because he got the fastest
Donington
lap?
Donington Park 2004. So
I think Muller was a great touring car driver. BTCC touring car driver internationally, BTCC driver, absolutely should be on this top 10 list.
In 1998, when he appeared for Audi, I can remember being with Robin Bradford commentating at Knock Hill, and I was in the pits, and as it tends to do at Knock Hill, it was wet and it was horrible. And it was probably practice in the days where the drivers would come into the pit lane and wait for the cars to arrive and you could then go and interview them. And as I embrace for the elements in my flat cap and I wander over to talk to Ivan Muller, he said, "You look like Nigel Mansell." And I never forgave him for that. So take off 100 points, take him off your list. The flip side of that is, I'll agree with Marcus, that move in the Vectra at Brands Hatch in an era where the racing was dire because the cars were so technical and complicated, overtaking was very rare. That's why we had one-shot qualifying and pit stop races to try and shuffle the order. That was some move. And anybody that is able to... Okay, he might not have won the championship every year, but he was always a race winner. He was always one of the benchmark drivers. So that longevity, I think, yes, he does deserve to be on the list. And for anybody to be able to attract middle-aged women to his own fan club, these people that used to walk around the paddock with the Ivan Muller fan club on their T-shirts, he's got to be doing something right, hasn't he?
Okay. All right, let's move on. You may hear some noise in the background, and obviously we don't apologise for it because this is the Autosport podcast, and so a bit of noise in the background is good. I'm not sure we can say what's going around today. It's a filming day of something.
Yeah, but I don't think it's a current...
No,
a car.
It has a very V8 tone.
It is an F1 machine. Someone's... but it's not anyone breaking the... That'd be brilliant, wouldn't it?
Wouldn't it be
we
great?
Broke
yeah.
the story because yeah. some team rocked up with a car and they thought no one was here. No, exactly. It's not. It's
Someone's having some fun today.
Yes.
So, but they're doing a film. They've got little drones and things whizzing about doing some filming. Right, let's move... Let's move on and let's go back a little bit, should we?
Yes. So, I mean, David mentioned benchmark there. This is number seven is one of the benchmarks in motorsport history. So number seven is Jim Clark, 1963 to 66. 8 wins. We'll come to White Solo in a moment and the 1964 title. So, again, this is one of those where if you were talking about the greatest drivers to appear in the championship, I mean, Ian Titchmarsh, who I discussed this list with some level of debate, it has to be said, prior to this, was adamant that Clark should be number one. But I don't think his impact on the championship is the same. He's not a British touring car driver. He is an all-time legend who dipped into it for fun and happened to have the best kit in the class as well. You know, he helped Colin Chapman develop the Ford Lotus Cortina, and he absolutely blew away everything in its class. He maybe had one or two cars to beat in his class that were competitive, and really he spent his time harassing the V8, you know, the Galaxies and Mustangs and things like that, which he didn't usually beat. He did score 7 outright wins in the Cortina, and he's the only person to do so, which is another, obviously, a massive boost for him. But he did normally have to rely on Jack Sears, who was the V8 benchmark, really, having some sort of problem to do those, to take those wins. And actually, Sears was another person to... If we were doing era by era, Sears was the earliest candidate for this list, really, as the first double champion. He's... Obviously, he was awesome, great driver, won against the odds. That is kind of one of the iconic championship images, isn't it, of Clark three-wheeling. Well, there's a brilliant picture of him at Snetterton sideways at the first corner, already coming out of the corner sideways with Mustangs and things all behind him. They got him in the end, but just you can see why fans would have loved that and why it was so great to watch. But actually he did just over 20 races in the championship, fewer than they managed in just a single season now. I didn't feel like I could really push him up any higher against drivers who were British touring car drivers, if that makes sense.
Mm. Yeah, and also very hard to compare eras as well, and drivers that didn't dedicate themselves to one particular series, or even four wheels or two. You know, they were good at everything, and it's very hard to then compare, you know, 40 years apart, different drivers.
Well, I've said before as well, you know, because some of the modern drivers get slagged off for not being versatile enough, but I think it's a nonsense, really. Basically, Clark was quicker than, say, Roy Salvadori in a Formula 1 car, and then surprisingly was quicker than him in a GT or a touring car. Yeah, it was basically the same drivers, just doing, you know, they'd do three or four runs, and it was usually the same order because they were quicker racing drivers. Now, if Lewis Hamilton and Max Verstappen were to jump into another championship, they'd be up against specialists in those categories, so they're not just going to dip in them. Like, they wouldn't make Ash Sutton look like an idiot the moment they rocked up in a British touring car, you know.
No.
So it's not really fair. I mean, Fernando Alonso has done a good job of showing that the current drivers can still jump into different things. So I don't really hold that against... That's not really a for or against either. It's just a difference in the years, I think.
But it was impressive that he was winning that championship along with driving in Formula 1, driving in Formula 2, Formula Junior, whatever Colin Chapman gave him that weekend to go and race in.
And the Indy 500.
And the Indy 500 as well, exactly. So, yeah, I mean, does he deserve to be on the list as a champion? Absolutely. As a driver, he is probably the best on the top 10 list. And we've yet to get to many of the names. But you're right, he wasn't perceived as being a pure touring car racer. You know, there are lots of people that we'll come to, no doubt, in other lists that are hugely capable drivers, but never made their impact on the championship in the same way that those that stayed around for year after year after year did. But yeah, I mean, the guy was just amazing in whatever you put him in. And it's a huge tragedy for any lover of the sport that he was killed Hockenheim and we didn't see what he could have achieved and how long he would have raced for.
Yeah, we didn't see a Clark versus Stewart, so we didn't see a Senna versus Schumacher for long enough.
You know, I'm going to be slightly heretical here, but I wouldn't put him on the top 10 list.
Because?
Is Jim Clark the greatest racing driver ever to race in the BTCC or British Saloon Car Championship, as it was then known? Yes, almost certainly. But we have to... But in my opinion, that was an era where there weren't really specialists in that form of racing. There weren't professional or career drivers who were British Saloon Car Championship drivers. There were professional drivers who did the British Saloon Car Championship along with other things. And one of the points I was going to make, Kevin touched on actually, but the would how would Max Verstappen get on against Ash Sutton now? You see, they weren't so Jim Clark was able to waltz into a championship where most of the drivers who were saloon car drivers were just chaps having a bit of fun at the weekend, and then the professionals would come in and quite rightly dominate them. But these days, it's now such a competitive arena of racing that if Max Verstappen finished off the British Grand Prix and then there was a BTCC race at the end of the afternoon Max was put into one of the Alliance Racing Ford Focuses, would he beat Ash Sutton? Absolutely not. Would he be competitive? He would potentially get in the top six or top eight, I think, if you discount hybrid boost tweaks for successful drivers and that, all that kind of thing. If Max Verstappen gave up Formula One to do the BTCC and did a full
That's a different season, question entirely, isn't it?
Would he beat Ash Sutton? Potentially not at first, at the start of the season, but he'd be absolutely there, wouldn't he? And what a battle that would be. We're talking about different eras. In my opinion, the late 50s when the championship started, the 60s and sort of into the 70s as well, just don't match up. And that's why it was someone like Jim Clark coming in and winning the championship. Well, of course he should do, because there just wasn't that level of professionalism. And that would be the argument I'd make, even though he is almost certainly the greatest driver ever to race in the championship.
But you look at who he was up against. I mean, you're right. There were people who were, there were happy ams going saloon car racing. But in terms of people that were winning either outright or their respective classes, there were people like John Fitzpatrick on the grid. There was Paddy Hopkirk. There was John Rhodes, who were all specialists in minis of the time. You had Jack Brabham winning races. You had Jack Sears winning races. He wasn't kicking cripples. I mean, there were some good people out there.
Yeah, but a lot of them were people who were racing drivers but weren't necessarily your Jack Brabhams and people like that.
Yeah, I agree.
So, who was in the class with Jim Clark?
Well, he did have.
He won every race in 64 in his class.
Yeah. He did, yeah. He's almost there for the overall snapping at the heels of the V8s. Yeah. I think we should represent different eras. So when we've talked about this in Formula One terms, it's very easy to bounce across the benchmark drivers from Fangio up to Verstappen, and we know who the drivers are in between, and then there are two or three annoying randoms that should be in there as well, like Alonso, but hasn't got the titles to back it up. But it was, and I tried to have a little element of that, but because it's so inconsistent, it's harder. And I thought having someone from the 60s who's also a double world champion in Indy 500 was kind of a... he's representing something, I think, there.
Brand me a heretic.
All right, one more before we take a quick break. And we get into the top five as well. Who's at number six?
So I guess Marcus might make similar arguments with this next driver. So number six is Frank Gardner, 96-3 to 65, but then his main time in the championship was 67 to 73. 35 wins, and he won the title three times. He's kind of the first sort of big dominator, multiple... Well, actually, he started off in the lower classes and winning there, but I think he's on this list because of getting into a Falcon sprint and blowing everyone away in the supercharged car in 67 when I think he had a car advantage. But then a bit later with Camaros, he was the benchmark as those V8s were the cars to have at the front of the field. He often lost the championship because he'd get beaten by Bill McGovern in the Bevan winning his class every time out. So he actually to win three championships in that context, including in and he should have won in 1970 as well with the Boss Mustang. And I think he had a tyre problem at Silverstone. He was the we're going to come across this later on in the list as well. Yes, it was the weird class system and the level. I'm not going to argue that the level was the same as it would be later. Of course not. But he was the guy during quite a decent period of time. And unlike Clark, he was consistently a British saloon car championship driver for getting on for a decade. So that and 35 wins actually that he took overall. That was the record for quite a long time. I think his last year was 73 before he went back to Australia. That wasn't beaten until someone else who might get mentioned on this list, a good sort of 15, 16, 17 years later. So, I thought he's representing the sort of the V8 side of the BTCC equation.
He gets credit for winning it from the big class, and he also gets credit for winning it from a smaller engine class like he did in 68 with the Escort.
Of course, the twin cam, yeah.
So he, if you like, can straddle both sides of that. And he was probably one of the first, if you like, professional touring car drivers. He'd come over from Australia. He'd quite quickly sent out his stall as somebody he wouldn't argue with and was able to deliver. And then if you go back, I know it's not the British Championship, but he then became a very successful team owner, didn't he, in Australia, running BMWs, running Ford. So his contribution to the sport and to touring car racing as a category was huge. And out of the car, he was always great for a one-liner. I think he, in terms of does he deserve to be on the list, yes, he does. And he was probably one of those drivers responsible for advancing it away from happy ams that we've touched on in 64 to just starting to up the level a little bit to the end of the 1960s when the cars are looking different, the racing's feeling different, and everything's looking a bit more professional.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of agree with David there.
Half on the fence. No, hanging off the fence.
Actually, that's unfair. Largely agree with David. So, does he deserve to be on the top 10? At first I thought not, actually, but then when you look at his longevity and also the fact that he was part of that era where we were beginning to get touring car specialists, and he was at the top of the tree, really. I mean, actually, Frank Gardner in his Chevrolet Camaro won the first two British saloon car championship races I saw as a six-year-old kid.
That's got to give him a bonus point.
At Thruxton in 1973. But in my... You know, so this is now 51 years ago. Oh, blimey. But I, my memory is that his only opposition was in the early laps Brian Muir in the BMW CSL and Dave Matthews in his Capri. And that would just be in the early laps before they fell away, and no one else was anywhere. Mm-hmm. So there was good battling amongst escorts, minis and imps and whatever, but they were one lap behind, two laps behind, whatever, by the end of the what seemed to be very, very long races. So so that was wasn't a great era of the championship, but he was the absolute king of it. And actually, when you're talking about the twin cam Escort and the Mustang beforehand, that was arguably a more competitive era than his last season, where he cleaned up in 73, really. And then of course because Group Two had got so expensive and boring racing, the regulations were changed for the following year to a more production spec, which sort of became colloquially known as Group One and a Half.
That's right.
So I would probably argue that I'm not upset to see him on the top 10. I would perhaps have him a little bit lower and put a couple of my beloved super touring drivers above him. But you can't discount his contribution to the sport and touring car racing, especially as David mentioned, running the team in Australia and those JPS liveried BMWs,
right.
Wasn't it?
Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant.
And then BNH Sierras.
JPS livery on anything is good, really, isn't it?
We'll keep him in.
All right. Okay, that's our first five done. And when we come back, we'll talk about our top five. Stick around. All right, welcome back to part two of our BTCC Touring Car, British Touring Car Champions List, the first of a brand new series. Now, the top five, probably not too contentious. There may be some arguments, but in terms of the names on the list, probably not too many arguments. But where they go on the list, let's find out if our guests are all in agreement. I suspect nods. All right, Kev.
The top five were easier than the 6 to 10
always
in terms of who would be in it.
It always is.
But the order was traumatic. So anyway,
number five
and still is.
Yes. Right. So number five is Alain Menu. 36 wins, 2 titles. Obviously, all in the super touring era. Pretty impressive strike rate, actually, as well, in terms of race wins, considering how competitive that period was. I admit I'm a sort of a late Menu convert. At the time, I was a teenager, and I wasn't a huge fan of his. I felt like he was great when he had a clear track, a brilliant qualifier, absolutely probably the fastest driver in the championship, him and Rydell. But when it came to sort of some of the racecraft stuff, I thought sometimes he was a little bit like, why are you in my space? But he wasn't alone in that era. And going back and watching some of the races again, I think actually, yeah, he was proper. And yeah, the only person to win 2 championships during that era as well, won miles more races than anyone else. I think he's 15 clear of Rydell during that period. So I thought super touring is the peak in the British Touring Car Championship. Although I would say that I think there were very few drivers on a given weekend who could actually win, because it was called it earlier on the F1 of touring cars, although to be fair, Marcus did then change that. And it is a bit like that, in that there were probably only, depending on which year you pit, there's only one or two cars that were going to win consistently. And if you weren't in it, you were stuffed. Whereas now, I think there are more cars that could potentially win. So I still think it's very hard to win the championship now. Whereas then, if you had the car advantage, you had the car advantage and away you went. So, that's my caveat on the super touring era. But yeah, so he was a nailed on in there in the list.
There were days when everything aligned for Alain that he looked like he was on a different planet. Kevin, you must have been on a different planet to put him only fifth.
Here we go.
He should be at the top of the list. Menu was an absolute star. And to a degree, I was a late convert to Alan. I, when he came into the championship, I thought he could drive. I wasn't struck by his personality until I got to know him away from the circuit doing a job for Ford. And we eventually hit it off, and then that was fine. But I thought he was a fantastic driver. He'd come out of single-seater racing, and like many of that era in Super Touring, single-seater line, single-seater racing was coming into touring cars. He made a good fist out of a pretty rotten Renault 19. He'd looked good already before he had his accident and broke his leg in 92 in the BMW that he raced for half a season. And when he got the right cars, like the Laguna, like the Mondeo, he was just outstanding. And continued to do that in the World Touring Car Championship. So he absolutely should be on the list. And for my money, he ought to be a lot higher.
The only reason he's not higher isn't so much a weakness with him as the bonus points that the people ahead of him score for various reasons, which we'll get to. So I'm not going to disagree with anything in terms of what we've said about...
But you're going to defend yourself.
...about menu, but I will defend myself, yeah. But Marcus is a bit... I mean, also, I don't think he was the quickest driver of the Super Team era, because that was long yellow, but that's a separate thing we'll get to on a different podcast. But yeah, go on, Marcus. I know you're a fan.
I absolutely agree that Alain Menu should be in the top five greatest BTCC champions of all time. I would also say that he should be in the top three greatest BTCC champions. And I would echo David by saying he should be in the top one greatest BTCC champions.
That's a very convoluted way of saying the same thing, wasn't it?
I think...
Spot the writer, spot the commentator.
Spot the man with a freedom of word count for the first time in his life. Yes. Yes. 30 words there.
I got to know him a little bit before David did. So before he was a touring car driver, I mean, my first year as an employed journalist was 1990, and he was racing in British Formula 3000, which I was covering. And straight away, just thought he was a lovely bloke. He was just... a dream to deal with. He then went the touring car route because A, he didn't have the budget to really go further in single seaters, and B, BMW took him on, and you're not going to say no to that. And then obviously he had the unfortunate quad bike accident in the paddock at Knockhill, which ruled him out for half a season. Went to Renault, and for various reasons, which we may cover in the top 10 super touring drivers or whatever. I don't want to waffle on too long in this one, but it wasn't really until 97 where a Renault was realistically able to take a championship, and he absolutely dominated that year with the Williams team running the Renault. Also, don't forget, he was regarded highly enough by Williams to be a Formula One test driver for them at the time as well. But actually, I think his 2000 championship success in the Ford Mondeo was a greater achievement, because he in 1997 he was in the absolutely dominant car that year was the Renault Laguna. His teammate was Jason Plato, but Jason was a rookie, and he was still finding his feet in the championship. In 2000 he was in the Ford Mondeo. He'd been in the Mondeo in 99, but it was quite uncompetitive that year. But ProDrive did a ton of work, all sorts of trickery on it for 2000. The best car that year, but he had Rickard Rydell and Anthony Reid in the other two cars alongside him. And actually, the Honda Accord was strong that year. The Vectra was strong on occasion. Matt Neal in the Nissan. I think, although the numbers were low in 2000, I think that's arguably the most competitive championship we had in the Super Touring era. And Menu won it in that dramatic finale here at Silverstone.
Under floodlights.
Yeah, under the floodlights. And was that because of the weather or because it was dark? Yeah,
it was meant to be a night race, wasn't it? To end the season, it was a Saturday night race.
I know, I was here. And it was the best climax to the championship. And that was, to me, that was his greatest achievement in the BTCC. And actually, had he...
yeah, obviously after that he went off to do the DTM with Opel. If he'd gone off to do the DTM with Mercedes, it might have gone a bit better for him. but had he stayed around in the BTCC for the first half of the 2000s, would he be a two-time champion? No, he would have won 3, 4, 5, and he'd be. Even Kevin would probably be putting him higher up the list. But
and he kept on winning in the World Touring Car Championship, and he also did. Played a part in the Ferrari 550 project at Le Mans, for example, with Colin McRae and with Ricard, wasn't it? A bit like you touched on with Giovinardi, it's a shame that he came back to the championship because he didn't have the car for the job, and he didn't look as clever as we all knew he was when he came back in the NGTC times. But if you take him from the 90s up to 2000, BTCC alone, absolutely top dollar.
Yeah, I included it in the stats, but I discounted it in terms of position because, NGTC craziness, basically. I think that's very difficult to, I think Plato's first conversation with Mike Jordan about getting into an NGTC, going, they're a bit weird, aren't they? Yeah. The word wasn't weird that he used. I'm paraphrasing. They've got a lot better now, I think, to be fair. Just to finish the menu loving, I met him for the first time properly at the Super Touring Power.
And he
was charming and brilliant and funny, and it was a pleasure to do the podcast with.
I'll get this out of the way, and you can edit it if it's boring. But in was it 99 or 2000 when he was with Ford, I ended up doing some work with Ford at the London Motor Show, and he knew who I was because I'd interview him after touring car races on the podium or whatever. But there wasn't much rapport between the two of us, and I ended up sat opposite at dinner on the first night. And it was at the time of year where the Formula One World Championship was about to be decided. And so this will reveal the year. It was after Michael Schumacher had his accident at Stowe here, and Eddie Irvine had a sort of chance of winning the championship. And Alain pulled a face and said, well, I hope Irvine doesn't win it, or word to that effect. And all of this stemmed from the fact that Alain was still a bit prickly about the fact that he'd been eliminated here at Silverstone in 1987. For the Esso Formula Ford Championship by Eddie's teammate. And I said, was that the year that Rory O'Coyle had you off at Copse on the first lap? And his eyes opened. I said, how do you know that? I said, well, I was here. I was watching it. And from that moment, that was it. It was as though Alain had sort of worked out that if you knew what you were talking about, you were okay. But it took him a long time, I think, to determine who was worth trusting or allowing into his confidence or whatever. I'm not saying that we became the best of friends, but it was one of those eureka moments. And after that, he was just, like you were saying, a joy to deal with.
Yeah. I mean, very similar experience I had with Alain when, in his British 3000 days, I then as now, I just like to watch trackside rather than, I just can't abide by watching on a screen in the press office. Might as well be watching it on telly at home.
Which I hear is very good.
And he, it's the commentary that makes it.
and he spotted me on the entry to Druids at Brands Hatch. That always impresses me with a driver if they say, oh, I saw you watching at whatever corner. George Russell actually was one in the mid-2010s in Formula 3. Because I just think you must have so much spare brain capacity. Yeah. You're driving the racing car, but you actually have spotted who's at various different corners. That's pretty impressive. I wouldn't be able to dig that. and he would ask, how did I look? quite good on turning. I think there was the... I think it's similar with quite a lot of good racing drivers where if you know what you're talking about, they'll strike up the rapport with you, and we know the people who ask silly questions at press conferences and stuff like that,
and also
who they naturally wouldn't have much time for.
Yeah, quite.
And in terms of how people were reflected of the time, of course, Super Touring was of a time when it transcended the motoring press, and it made its way into the front pages and back pages of the mainstream press back then, which, thank goodness, we're in a different era to what it was now, but there was always a need to have a Dick Dastardly. You and I have talked about before, like I remember being here in 94, And it was like, bad German Michael Schumacher, good Brit Damon Hill. And thank goodness we're in a different era now. But there was an element of, that Frenchman who is over here winning things. And it's like there was this need to portray people in a sort of in a pantomime way, which then infiltrates things, I think, unfortunately. So if you know a little bit about motorsport and you can sift through all that, then you can pick out the good ones.
That's got to be a segue to number four, hasn't it?
Someone who is always to be. Happy to play the pantomime villain.
Before we finish with the
it's turning to the Alain Menu podcast. Well, this is.
The last thing about Alain, Swiss rather than French, just to give him credit for being from a funny place in the world. But he's one of the few people from the British Touring Car Championship that was a question on the Question of Sport on the BBC. Because there was a food-related question, and so menu was a.
So it was menu.
Yeah, was there. So that again, to take your point, Martin, about transcending from sports pages to the public consciousness. There, he was somebody that kind of did that in a way. Right, next.
Let's move on. So, I hope he is back at Super Touring Power this year because a huge fan base still.
Well, we want to get him in a car.
Yeah,
he looked a little bit like, maybe I should have got in a car because I had his 96.
I think first we need to persuade him to get a license, don't we?
I mean, that would be that would be helpful. you guys like us so much, give him a call.
He's Swiss, so he won't like paying for his own license.
I think there's some editing that may be required in this.
If you're listening to this in October, you'll know that it all worked.
Let's move on.
Right, so number four, Jason Plato. I mean, he was in and out of the championship for 25 years. 97 wins if we conveniently overlook the races where the BTCT cars didn't catch the BTCP cars, which we just all ignore now. None of the stats for these drivers include the fact that the races where they didn't catch.
You haven't given Roger Moan
exactly,
that
yeah. So we've got, because they used to start them with a hand. Insanity.
But a win is a win. I would argue with that.
Yeah. So 97 wins and two titles, 2001, 2010. Now, I think that with the possible exception of someone else on this list, we'll get to later, I think Jason has done more for the championship than any other driver. He's consistently brought funding in. He's brought different manufacturers in. He has played a bit of a role. I think he would say that he played a character, quite often the villain.
Very high profile that he played up to, obviously with his TV and
TV
stuff.
TV as well.
Everyone knows who he is.
Well, he very early on realised that, I mean, quite apart from the whole haranguing Frank Williams at his, the car park at Williams to get himself a drive in the first place, he knew that there would be plenty of drivers, especially during the Super Touring era, who were brilliant in the car. They were all within nothing. So he needed to bring something else to the party, whether that was high profile, bit of a character, sponsorship. And that was all. I find it kind of funny that obviously Plato and Alan Gow have had this kind of slightly odd relationship for so long, but actually they've each done the other a massive favour. Jason is a wealthy man because of a lot of things that Alan did, and Alan's got a successful championship partly because of the role that Jason played within it. Two-time champion. His 97 wins are going to take a long time to get. I don't think Colin's going to make it. I think he's going to run out of steam. Ash might get there. Ash Sutton might get there. But it's a big number, and it's actually not a bad strike rate either. It's ahead of someone like Matt Neal, for example. It's fewer races. Still over 600 races. I mean, he had to be high on this list for me. The only thing, two things really that count against him, and they're related. One is that he only converted two championships, so it's like the Yvonne Müller thing. Sometimes he was unlucky. Like I covered the 2011 championship, and this is where I fell out with Matt Neal and Gordon Chen, because they had a massive turbocharged advantage with that Honda, and had it been parity of power, Plato and the RML Chevrolet would have absolutely killed that championship and won Ash Sutton levels of victories. But so he didn't win that. He obviously had the year against Giovinardi where he got caught in a he had the injuries from the Caparo thing, but he also got himself into scrapes too often, really, partly playing that role. But there were times where he some of his moves on track were pretty out there.
But Jason wanted to win races, and he'll admit this, that he was savvy enough with his sponsors to write into those contracts win bonuses. Now, you tell me what the numbers were. I won't reveal them, obviously. But it was important for Jason to win races. And if that meant that move was the difference between no quid or a few thousand quid, it was worth having a go. With 97 wins, he did pretty well out of those sponsors in the later years when that was in the contract. So, on paper, he should have won more championships. But in terms of race wins, and the commitment to the championship. I mean, you could argue he kept it going, really. I mean, that rivalry with Matt Neal was genuine, but they certainly knew how to play it to give the story, the championship, a narrative when it was pretty weak on numbers.
But actually, he hates that rivalry, doesn't he? Because he regards himself as a better driver than Matt, so he doesn't think he should be in a rivalry with it, which I think explains some of that. I mean, the famous Snetterton 07 or 08 when Matt caught him on the last lap. I mean, some of the driving there. I mean, Matt even tries to do a fair move on him into the final chicane, and he still biffs him off.
Jason's commercial savvy is as impressive, if not more, than his driving ability, because he was always able to sort of read where the next deal was coming from. So if you think about the way that he very quickly got in bed with Seat, threw his hat into that ring, worked with them on the One Mate Championship, worked with the prize drive, which generated Rob Huff, worked with Seat on the diesel, was quickly able to work out the regulations on a reverse grid, so he gave away a win on the line to get pole position for the next race. He was able to bring MG into the championship. He was able to work with Subaru. He was able to work with KX. All these different either manufacturers or backers. And he quickly worked out that he could be a very big fish and well rewarded in a small pond. Whereas if he'd done, let's say, like Andy Prio and go off and race in the European or the World Championship, and he did race in the World Championship here 1 year, he'd be forgotten about. He'd be ignored. He'd just drop off the radar. And key to Jason's commercial side was being on the radar. Not long after I got involved in the championship, I got a text message at some ungodly hour of the morning, number I didn't recognise. And when I worked out who it was Jason, who had got home and had watched the coverage. And I'm reliably informed that he would get home at whatever time, watch the coverage, and tot up how much time his sponsors were getting on screen. So at 9 o'clock the following morning, he could email them and say, yesterday you got this amount of commercial benefit. Now, that may or may be an apocryphal story, but I'm tempted to believe it of Jason because he is that commercially savvy. He could drive a racing car very well. He was brilliant with the sponsors. And if you look at what Tom Ingram is doing now, he is being Jason Plato in a less pantomime villain way. You know, he's got the merchandise. He's brilliant on social media. And you know, Tom said to me years ago that Jason was his model, and he's doing it.
And he's a KX Academy graduate.
Precisely.
And he's not the only one either, because Josh Cook is as well. So yeah. There's that influence as well.
Absolutely.
That he's had.
And, and so not only has he had a big part to play in the championship, you could argue in the development of drivers and in the development of the personality of drivers. And love him or hate him, I think more people loved him. And even if they did hate him, they'd still get his autograph. And it was fascinating, again, a couple of years ago, seeing drivers away from a touring car weekend is always really revealing. So before Croft, 2 years ago, I ended up doing a day with QuickFit and four or five drivers at Goodwood. And we had Adam Morgan, we had Josh Cook, we had Dan Camish, we had Jason. And when there were the autograph signings, it was fascinating to watch how they all operated. So the other three would sign an autograph and smile, and they'd have a photograph taken if that was required. People would come up to Jason. Let's say it's 11 o'clock in the morning. And case in point, little chap, step forward. Can I have your autograph, please? No. Not signing autographs till 11 o'clock. Oh, it's 11 o'clock. You're in luck. Come on. And he played with him. And he toyed with him. And the next person in the queue, I like your hat. That's a cool hat. Can I borrow your hat? Take a picture of me in your hat. Things like this. And he was brilliant at working the audience. And even if you went into that queue for his autograph not liking Jason Plato, you came away under his spell. Now, I'm not saying that everything Jason has done has been fantastic. I've had my arguments with him, and lots of people in the paddock have had their arguments with him. But for somebody as a racer and a commercial brain in that paddock, he has played a massive part in the success of the championship over the last 20 years.
Yeah, I mean his importance to the championship goes beyond the driving level. There is a funny story on the commercial side actually. One of the reasons why Jason is the person he is now and who we all know is because he had to scrap and fight his way up the sport, and he spent the best part of a couple of years out of it, not actually driving competitively for 94 and most of 95, wasn't it? I think Before he came back in the Renault Spiders. Right. He did a bit of Formula Renault at the end of 95, but then the late Tim Jackson from Renault sort of swerved him towards Spiders, says, this is going to be good for you. So he did that. And it was good for him. Tim was absolutely right. But the commercial side, and it just popped into my head in my early days at Motoring News. I worked with Mark Hughes, who's now the sort of well-known Formula One journalist, Warren Hughes' older brother. Yeah. And he and Warren used to race karts at Fulbeck in the northeast. And Jason Plato was, same age as Warren, give or take a few months. So Jason and Warren would probably have been in the same class. And Mark would tell me, oh, blimey, that Jason Plato, he used to come round the paddock selling these stupid stickers, like Carters do it 2 inches off the ground or something like that. I can't remember exactly. But
and there was a deal to be done.
He just used to give him a pound to go away. So and that was Jason as a kid.
Yeah.
He absolutely fought his way up the sport, to get the Williams Renault drive for 97, as we know, as we've mentioned, and absolutely, within a few years, had become the personality star of the BTCC, hadn't he? Really. The other thing, you mentioned just the two championships against the 97 race wins, but also I'd like to add in that for the first several years of Jason racing in the BTCC, there were only two races a day.
True.
So we've been on the current three race a day format, he'd be well into three figures and counting even beyond that, wouldn't he?
I just wish that the last few years of his career hadn't had all the negativity. You know, whatever happened at Subaru in that second season, I'm sure one day we'll get the full story. And then, you know, the Powermax Astra was an okay car, but it wasn't a mega car. And then the BTC Honda, he really struggled with. And people that came into the championship as fans in the last few years will be listening to this probably thinking, but he was rubbish. He never did anything in the last 2 or 3 years. And that's really a poor reflection and a sad reflection on Jason at his pomp, at his height, because he was far better than those last 2 or 3 seasons made him look.
I'd agree.
It's a real sadness
completely.
Not that he didn't have 100 wins or not that he didn't have another title anymore, but that he wasn't able to go out as a front runner. And I think that's all Jason really... Okay, yes, he'd have liked the championship, he'd liked the wins, but to be up at the front and scrapping and to keep proving to people that I can still do this, you know, against a Sutton or an Ingram or whoever, still be a front runner. I think it's a real sadness that we weren't able to enjoy that to the end of his career.
Yeah, and I think he was absolutely sensational driver. Actually, funnily enough, I keep banging on about the Super Touring era, but the era when I think he was potentially at his peak was the RML Chevrolets. That day where he won all three races on the Brands Hatch Grand Prix circuit, that was absolutely extraordinary, wasn't it? Because that was actually quite a competitive era then, wasn't it? Colin Turkington, Fabrizio Giovinardi, and that, you have to take your hat off to something like that.
I mean, the job that he did with the 888 MG, I mean, that was not a good basis for a touring car. I know there's obviously a lot of spec parts, NGTC and stuff, but him and Carl Foe, I mean, they won 20 races across 3 seasons. And I think at that time, there was no one else on the grid that would have been able to do that.
And it was almost single-handed. I mean, I know in that first year there was a second car, but in terms of gathering data and being the trailblazer up the front, that was all down to Jason as the driver. And yes, Carl Foe was a great engineer. But I think he's much missed from the paddock, actually.
Mm. All right, into the top three. And number three.
Yeah, so I think any BTCC fan will have worked out that the 3 4-time champions are in the top three of this list.
Well, let's
which is perhaps predictable.
It's up to you whether you want to do number two and number one together, but let's do number three certainly on its own.
Okay, fair enough. Well, number three is Colin Turkington. 68 wins, the 4 titles, 2009, 14 and 18, 19. The thing I like about Colin's work, well, first of all, I think he's a very clean racer, which for me gives him bonus points over someone like Jason, who I think did get into a few scrapes. I take David's point that that was perhaps deliberate at times. But Colin goes about his racing like the way I like to see it, really. I remember watching him, actually he'd been taken out by Jason the race before. Second race in Nottingham in 2014, I think it was, and he went from 27th to 4th, and there wasn't a single mark on the BMW at the end. And I just thought, that's a class act, actually. And he won the championship in different ways. You know, he had that fantastic fight to take his first title against Giovinardi and Plato in 2009. In 2014, he had the best car and he smashed it. Would have had more wins had it not been for Jason taking him off at Knockhill and at Brands. So he would have been into double figures. And then in 2018, he didn't have the car. But by then, I think Gow got fed up with WSR BMWs being so good, and the 1 Series being so good. So that was turned down, and he just kept scoring podiums and points, and he won the championship with one win, which normally I would hate. But in the context of British touring cars, I think is fair enough. And then in 2019, he had an ace teammate in 2013 champion, Andrew Jordan, who came out on top there. So he's kind of won the championship in every which way. The only thing he hasn't done is he didn't win the championship in a front-wheel drive car. It's when he was with Jason at BMR, and the first year with the Volkswagen front-wheel drive, Jason was quicker, Plato was better, and then when they switched to Subarus, Colin was ahead. So they kind of underlined their positions as the preeminent front and rear-wheel drive drivers at that particular point.
He did win races, though, in the Volkswagen.
Yeah, yeah. I'm a huge fan of Colin's. I think,
and in Fiestas.
Indeed.
I mean, this is perhaps a question to you guys. Have we seen the best of him now? I think it feels like Jake Hill in that team is beginning to get the momentum, and maybe Colin will be at 4 titles, and I wouldn't be surprised to see him in a showdown, but has he got that last little bit now to take a 5th?
I think it's in true sitting on the fence style. I think it's too early to say.
Go on, David.
I think that there's no question that the last couple of years the BMW hasn't been the car to have in the British Touring Car Championship. In 2022, Tom Ingram and his engineer Spencer Aldridge did fantastic work on the Hyundai. They were out testing as soon as the 21 season finished. They didn't have the hybrid parts, but they had the hybrid weight to put on the car, so they were able to simulate exactly what they needed and hit the ground running in 22, and that car was absolutely superb. And then the team formerly known as Motorbase, but now Alliance, were similarly well prepared across the 22-23 off season with the Ford Focus. And so Colin has had times when he has had the best car. There's no question about that. As you mentioned, they had to turn down the BMWs.
Allegedly.
Or turn up the other cars.
Yeah, well, of course.
Someone like Jake Hill coming into that environment, still with everything to prove, absolutely cracking on, smashing on with everything. He's absolutely, Jake is one of the most determined drivers behind the wheel of a car that you'll ever see. He has got the better with Colin, got the better over Colin the last couple of seasons, as we've seen in their final championship placings. But I hear that there's a lot of work going on the BMW over this winter. If that car comes out this year as a Ford Focus rival or even beta, would that then give us another potential Colin title? Because he has won 4 championships. He's then in a situation where he's having to scrap a little bit with a car that's not the best. He's into his early 40s. It's possibly going to be more the territory for a Jake Hill to be the best driver in the championship rankings. So potentially, if the car is good, I think there's potential. We might see some Colin back to his best.
I'm in danger of sitting on the Marcus Simmons memorial fence because I don't know is the short answer. I think Colin can still do it, still deliver. I mean, you talked about coming from the back of the grid at Knockhill. He did it at Alton Park last year, had a rotten qualifying in terms of the car being excluded, put to the back of the grid for race one, and he won race three, sort of chipped his way forward as the day went on, and it was Colin at his best. And it's hard to overtake around Alton Park. Is there another title in Colin? Yes. Is there going to be mega wins to a season? I don't think there is, but I think Colin can still win the championship by banking points. And it's not everyone's cup of tea to win a championship like that. But he's clever enough, savvy enough, understands the championship enough to play the long game. And there are other drivers that want to do it now. They want to get this place now. They want to win this race because they have to do it. They've got to go for broke now. And Colin just has a different attitude about that. You know, he's almost one of the elder statesmen of the championship now. He's seen it. He's done it. He's got God knows how many T-shirts. I'd love to see him win a fifth championship, and I think he would be hugely deserving so to do. But will he be winning race after race after race over the 30 of the season? No, but he'll win some. But I think that he's more likely to win a championship than a bag full of races, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And actually, this is a champions list.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons he's so high is I think more than probably anyone else on this list, with the possible exception of number two, which is still a work in progress. That gives it away, doesn't it? Has worked out how to win the British Touring Car Championship better than anyone else. And he absolutely knows how to do it. And that's why he's so high.
Number two and number one, together or separately?
Let's do them together.
All
even
right.
Though they're, I mean, comparing them is really quite tricky.
It's really hard. It's different areas. Yeah. But so, let's try.
Okay, so number two is Ash Sutton. With his four titles, three in rear wheel drive machinery, one in front wheel drive, which is one of the reasons I popped him up ahead of Colin. I think to be the first person to achieve that and to do it with the Focus, which, you know, the Focus was there when I was covering the championship. The Ford Focus has been a part of the championship for a decade and has never looked like a championship winning car until Ash got.
I remember the super production Ford Focuses of the early team.
Oh, yeah, yeah, of course, yeah. And so that gives him a bit. And I think all three of these top guys were what I'd regard as clean racers. But yeah, so number one is Andy Rouse, also a four-time champion. The reason he's ahead, I'm not suggesting for one moment that Andy Rouse is a faster, better driver than Ash Sutton or content or a lot of the drivers on this list, but his impact and success over such a long period, different types of regulations. He went in the class here, he came out of the class, the lower classes, won the championship there, came through, became a front runner overall, ended up losing more titles than he won because of the class system. You know, if it had just been a one class system in the 80s, he'd have reeled off another three with various turbocharged Fords. Obviously, he was the king of the RS500. So Ash's story isn't yet finished. And if he goes on if he stays in the British Touring Cars, I think his success, if he adds in fifth, sixth, seventh titles, even though he can't ever really have the impact that Rouse had because of the era that he's working in, he will potentially overtake Rouse in this list. But at the moment, I think, you know, Rouse was competitive from, you know, Group A, from before Group A, through that, into the early days of Super Touring, was a race winner even in 92, you know, the most famous race in British touring car history, you know, the Soper, Clelland crashing into each other, Harvey winning the championship. Andy Rouse won that race under huge amounts of pressure at the age of 40, whatever he was at the time.
And that was his, very close to the end of his
career. It was his 60th final victory. Yeah. And it wasn't until 2011, when Jason Plato was at the RML Chevy team, that total got surpassed. And Rouse's strike rate for his career is way ahead of any of the other people on this list, with the possible exception of Gardner. I think Gardner was...
But he was in it for a long time.
He was in it for a long time. And had he had 10, you know, for three races per... Imagine the numbers would have been absolutely ridiculous. Now, obviously, the argument is that it wasn't as competitive during most of his career. But the fact that he was still competitive in Super Touring, the fact that he could see off the Eggenberger Works Fords when they came over, or go and win the TT here when he dropped into their backyard, win it from different classes, develop his own cars. At one point, he was providing cars for other teams. You know, really, and he was one of the architects of the Super Touring regulations as well, if we're looking outside of the cockpit. For me, he's just... Ash is the better driver. But I think at this point, Andy Rouse's weight of impact on the championship gets him to the top.
Well, you have two people here who
I'm trying to read their faces. David'd be good at poker. I bet you're a good poker player, aren't you?
He hasn't given anything away. But they, you know, Rouse is sitting on Menu's throne, according to these two. But let's find out if they agree with your order of one and two.
Well, I think you've given it to Andy Rouse, because what's Ash Sutton ever done? He's only won 3 BTCC titles and rear-wheel drive cars, and Andy's won 4. So.
where the wheels should be driven.
But I think the more Kevin spoke there, the more I thought, yeah, this is always a difficult thing with these top 10 lists. You're comparing apples with oranges, really, aren't you? So Andy came from an era when it was possible to run your own team, engineer your own car, develop your own car. He was brilliant at that, and therefore put himself in the best car for many of his years of success. So driving wise, that makes it less impressive, but because the competition through much of Andy's years of winning the championship was not anywhere near as strong as it is now. And when you look at this, when you look at the mid-80s, when actually he didn't win the championship in the mid-80s, but it was absolutely on its knees, the championship. He was winning a lot of races, but he was not winning the championship because Chris Hodgetts was doing that in a small class Toyota. So that makes the driving feat less impressive. But then, as you mentioned, Kevin, he won the TT at Silverstone. Okay, Silverstone was his backyard as a circuit, but the championship certainly wasn't his backyard, because you'd have expected the Eggenberger cars to do that. And Andy Rouse did the hard yards in that car, because Alain Ferté, his teammate, was a great Formula 2 driver, but he wasn't a renowned touring car specialist at the time. And so he was a great touring car driver, but arguably operating in one of the poorer areas of the championship. Now, could Ash Sutton now do what Andy Rouse did, as in set up his own team, engineer the car, give himself a car advantage? I don't think anyone can do that these days, because we're in a completely different landscape now. Ash Sutton would probably engineer a pretty good car, wouldn't he, I reckon? But if he was able to. But my thinking, yes, Ash Sutton is probably the more impressive feats as a driver across his 4 championship wins. But as far as an overall contribution to the BTCC in terms of engineering, team ownership, driving, framing rule sets that are going to completely revolutionise touring car racing, which he did as part of the Toker group in the early 90s, then has there ever been a more important person in BTCC history? I don't know. But I'd put both of them behind Alain Menu.
Sutton's an easy one, because he's a class act. He is one of the two best drivers of the modern age. Him and Tom Ingram are the fastest, most fearless, most exciting drivers that we have on the grid now. And they've not peaked yet. They're going to get better. They're going to win races. They're going to win championships. So they are still star drivers. And Ash Sutton, I think he's an absolutely mega driver. He gets a car by the scruff of the neck. He's a joy to watch. Even when it's standing still, it looks quick with Ash at the wheel of it. So to have him on the list and to have him up near the top of the list, totally agree with. Rouse in the top 10, yes, way down. No way should he be up at the top. Absolutely no way. 1975, when he won his first championship, 3 drivers went to the last round tied on points. And that was a contentious win in his Dolomite sprint, because he was alleged to have overtaken under a yellow at the last corner when, was it Brian Muir, backed off and it ended up in the clerk of the courses room. But that was a bit iffy. But that was from the classes anyway. So he's not winning overall races, which goes back to one of your earlier points that you want people to do that. 1983, if anything, illustrated his ability to engineer a car, because he took over Pete Hall's Alpha at the Race of Champions in practice, because Pete said he couldn't get his hat on with it. We'd already had a couple of races. We'd had Alton Park, we'd had Silverstone prior to that. But there was hardly anybody in Class B. That was the first year of Group A. The Metro Turbos were late being homologated.
Wouldn't Hamish Irvine's RX-7?
Hamish Irvine's RX-7 was staggering around. But he had limited opposition. The biggest problem Rouse had in 83 was scoring enough points because there weren't enough cars in the class for him to get full points. The Metro Turbos were late coming into Class B because they weren't homologated. So he didn't have much opposition for the early part of the season. The fact that he was able to win the championship having not done every race illustrates to a degree how weak it was. And bear in mind that he only won it anyway because the Rovers that won Class A were excluded from not every race, as the common myth says, but a number of races, which therefore took away their points and gave Rouse the 83 championship. In 84, he finds himself in the top class in a Rover Vitesse up against TWR Rovers that a quarter of a way, halfway through the year, pull out because the 83 debacle has gone to the High Court. The Shawcross Tribunal has ruled and Austin Rover have said, stuff this, we don't like Group A anymore, we're back to rallying. So at a stroke, some of his opposition there has gone. 85, again, giving credit for developing the Mercury, the XR4 Ti, but now the championship's suffering the effects of 84 and 83, so the grid is weak. So that car wasn't on the grid for the first round. He debuted at Alton Park, he won it there. But Marcus is right, the championship was weak then. Yes, he could only beat the people he was up against. The racing was a different style as well. It wasn't as elbows out as it is now. To give you an idea of how weak 85 was, in order to get the lead at Alton Park, he had to try and get past Brian Chatfield's ex-Vince Woodman Ford Capri that was as old as the hills and was as that was excluded from fourth place because it was bent as a three-bob note in the end anyway. It wasn't anything like a Group A car. And then you get to 86, which is getting a bit more competitive. Now, Marcus's point about Chris Hodgetts doing his bit and winning from the classes is right. But bear in mind, by 87... the reason Rouse didn't win the championship in 87 with his RS500 wasn't that Chris Hodgetts was winning from the classes. It was that he wasn't doing the whole season. He was off doing the World Touring Car Championship with Thierry Tassin, where reliability of his Rouse-prepared Sierra was not mega. Quite often, it would fail. So I'm not sure I buy into your engineering point either. 88, Tourist Trophy win. Yeah, fine. He outlasted them, and he did beat the Eggenberger cars, but the fastest Sierras were Dick Johnson's cars that had never been here before and showed everybody what a quick Sierra was, to the point that Rob Gravett and Mike Smith went and bought Johnson Sierras, not Rouse Sierras, for the year after. I agree with the Rouse contribution to the rule set, and I think what Rouse did with the early Mondeos and delivering a car for Paul Radisich to do great things with in 94 was very good. I'm not for a moment saying he wasn't a quality driver, but to use the phrase again, he was of a time. And I think, sadly, a lot of his championships, you can construct an argument for either the weakness of the championship and or the political machinations around it that maybe don't give Andy the credit he deserves. He wasn't a dirty driver. He was demon fast. He was versatile. He could jump from car to car. One of the reasons, for example, that Andy Rouse Engineering had to start was that he was so quick in a Gordon Spice Capri against Gordon Spice that Gordon moved him on at the end of the year, and Andy needed something to do. He had to go and form his own company, effectively, and prepare cars with Charles Sawyer-Hoare in the second one in order to stay on the grid. So he clearly was no slouch, and he'd come out of single-seaters in Formula Ford and whatnot, so he knew how to drive. But I can't, with the evidence submitted, Your Honour, buy into the fact that he's up at the top of that top 10. He's no better than a Menu. He's no better than a Sutton. In the top 10, yes, but I'll put him down in the 8th, 9th
So in
area.
Terms of the driving, I would put a Menu and a Sutton ahead. But it's the... I think it's from his driving achievements point of view, it's actually when he stops winning the championship. It's when he's the RS500 king. Because I don't want to give away too much about what might happen in the cars podcast, but the RS500 features in the top 10 yeah. British Touring Cars. Yeah. And I don't think anyone would argue that Rouse was not the king of that. You know, he was done over in the end by Rob Gravett and Yokohama tyres.
And a Johnson-built car.
But I think he would have beaten him anyway without the Yokos, and I think Tim Harvey would agree, because he was the main guy following them for most of that period. So, you know, being the king of the RS500 and then being a consistent fun runner in the first couple of years of the 2 litre is kind of what, for me, ticks the actually he was a quality driver. Well, actually, you did also mention the Gordon Spice. Like, no one was quicker than Spice in a Capri, with the possible exception of Rouse on occasion. Spice still came out ahead more often than not.
We have to remember that it was also in, you know, those first couple of years of super touring with the Toyota Carina, and he
as you mentioned, he won his 60th and final BTCC win at the famous 92 championship showdown finale, which everyone forgets because of what happened with everybody else. That was he was adapting to front wheel drive after years and not in the first flushes of youth by then either. So to do that, and you know, Will Hoy was his teammate in 92. They famously had that shunt together at Brands when they were both going for the same bit of road. So to be up with those guys in those early years of super touring and being in a front wheel drive 2 litre car, which is completely foreign to what he'd been in before, I think that's probably more impressive to me than, say, his Alfa GTV 6 championship success in 82.
I mean, the GTV 6 was clearly the best car that he ever drove because it was just a glorious sound. But like I say, he wasn't up against many people. At 83, I mean, there's a podcast in the 1983 championship, if ever you have the time, because that was such a convoluted year anyway. Rouse could drive, but I don't consider him to be up in the higher reaches of your top 10. But I agree with what the contribution to the sport helped, possibly by him being a front runner in the early days of television. So instantly he became, if you like, the face of the BTCC, one of the faces, because he was winning races early on. So for people happening across the championship on grandstand, there was this guy, Andy Rouse, that was a winner, and there was a bit of support around him.
I will concede that as a kid, it was the Calibra RS500. That is what I wanted to win. What is this Texaco thing rocking up? Who is this person, Steve Saper, and all that sort of stuff as a kid? So, I completely accept that on the driving fun, but for me, the weight of everything else gets him ahead, with the caveat that I think, well, actually a couple of people on this list, but particularly Ash Sutton. Well, Rouse won 9, if you include his overall titles, he won 9 class titles in British Touring Cars. Ash hasn't even done that yet. He's only done 8 seasons, so the fact that he's even in the debate is incredible. So I if we do this in 5 or 10 years' time, this is one list that I think that we'll move around. But I probably still won't put menu number 1.
I told you you're in for a kicking on this one, didn't I?
To be fair, I've quite enjoyed it. It's been good.
I think you've been turned over pretty well.
But it's nice that Kevin is accepting he's wrong.
Yeah, absolutely.
Don't remember saying that.
That's our first podcast of this brand new series. Hope you've enjoyed it. We will be back very soon. We'll be talking about the best cars, the non-champions, and of course we'll do a big one on the Super Touring era as well. But for this show, thank you for listening, and we'll see you on the next one. Sports Social Podcast Network.